It's showtime.
Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running on this, the fourth day of May, 2021. May the 4th be with you. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. That's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place during the hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific. And where, if you pop in right now, you'll be greeted by early arriver Squeaky and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, although he is a third stage guild navigator, has, yes, declined to fold space and remains Sparky instead of Mancave. Hi, I'm Robin. It is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, and I guess there's no space folding in Northern California because the 91 is the forecast high with a bunch of wind, so Sparky's staying where it's nice and climate-conditioned, cool, and comfortable. Yeah, makes sense to me. Let's see. Like I said, Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, and every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. And that means we have thanks to send out. Oh, yes, we do. We have thanks to send out to Thomas. Thank you to Thomas, and thank you to David. Thank you to Paul. Thanks very kindly for being partial sponsors of the program. Thank you so very much to our fourth day of the month subscribers. Thank you very much. If you'd like to be a subscriber, of course, you can just run over to headon.live, and it's right there, the PayPal interface on the main page. And if you want, just check that you want to make it happen monthly, and you will be one of the set-it-and-forget-it subscribers. Recall, please, that a $10 a month subscriber puts themselves out to the tune of not quite a half a stick of Juicy Fruit gum per day. Man, that's a hell of a lot, isn't it? Yeah. No, what it means is that this remains one of the best broadcast bargains in America. Independent, liberal, progressive broadcasting. And so our fundraising goal for the day is at $300. And hopefully we will knock all or some portion of that down and keep on an even keel so that since we have broadcasting in May, that we will also have broadcasting in June. That's the whole purpose. That's the plan. Yeah. And, of course, to get us started, this evening, Robin, Star Wars Day, may the 4th be with you. Yes, it is the 51st anniversary, Joey writes, of the Kent State shootings. When you say May 4th, that's what comes to my mind, because I remember the look on my father's face when he hugged my mother after returning home from his canceled master course classes at Kent State, that dubious day in history, just a horrible, terribly bad day in the history of this country. The actions at Kent State were just another in the many misguided moves by a Republican governor, which just seems to happen and continues to happen day after day after day with this misguided Republican Party. Yes, Republican Governor James A. Rhodes of Ohio completely overreacted to the torching of the very small ROTC building by sending in the stoked-up National Guard to deal with a bunch of generally peaceful protesting unarmed college students. And, you know, gave them live ammo. Now, Jeffrey would like to register his protest.
Yes, may the 4th be with you, and don't be afraid to come over to the Darth side. Last night I was just sithing through the Star Wars characters because I'm not really familiar with Star Wars, being a giraffe and all. However, I would classify myself as a Wookiee, a neophyte. I'm a neophyte because I'm anti-war and would have been protesting on May 4th along with the courageous young people at Kent State back in 1970, some 51 years ago today. No question, I would have been protesting against Ohio's Jabba the Hutt of that time period, James Rhodes, just as I've been protesting the Jabba the Hutt of this time in history, Donald J. Trump, and the J stands for Jabba. Okay, time out. That works. In the Star Wars saga, Jabba the Hutt was a gangster and a crime lord, just like Donald Jabba the Gut Trump. Okay, that's two. Is in real life today. Yes, one more four-year term of Donald Jabba the Gut would have gutted this country.
Jeffrey seems to be in a protesting mood from up on high.
I find it interesting that Governor Rhodes of Ohio brought out the guns to take out the protesters up here in Ohio, and now for two governors from Florida and Oklahoma are going to use the wait for it. Yes, both Ron DeSantis and Kevin Stitt, you know, pile of Stitt, governors of Florida and Oklahoma, respectively, if you'll excuse the term respectively. And there's a difference between that and respectful, you know. Signed into law legislation to use the roads, R-O-H-E-D-E-S, oh dear God, to rule to help people run over protesters with their cars. By the way, I was wondering if the good governor of Oklahoma likes Jabba the Gut, you know, Trump, the previous president who had a picture of Andrew Jackson hanging on the Oval Office wall. You know, Andrew Jackson, the president who chased the Cherokee Nation all the way, and the Chickasaw, and the Choctaw, and the Muskogee. All the way from Georgia and Alabama, all the way to Oklahoma. Oh, and guess who just happens to be of Cherokee descent? That's right. The one and only Governor Kevin Pile of Stitt has Cherokee blood and lives in Oklahoma. One can only wonder if the Cherokee Nation ever protests again, will the good governor be okay with Jabba the Hutt's nuts running his relatives down and wait for it? Yes, running his... any protesting Native Americans with their Jeep Cherokee SUVs? Oh, dear.
Did someone mention a kangaroo last night? Oh, no, the goddess of irony is again working full-time, and I'll explain that one in tomorrow's Joey's Journal. And, of course, the great screwball artist Carl Hubble. Oh, boy. Looks like that'll be in Thursday's Joey's Journal. However, we'll finish up with Eddie Fainer, who was the great underhanded fast-pitch softball pitcher featured on the King and his court softball team. Fainer did actually strike out Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, Brooks Robinson, Roberto Clemente, Maury Wills, and Harmon Killebrew in a row in 1967 during a charity softball game, as Robin mentioned last night. Oh, and I didn't know giraffes could make a pitch, but here's a pitch from Giraffery. However, Eddie Fainer may have struck out more in a row if Hank Aaron, Lou Brock, and Reggie Jackson, all waiting on deck, had not grabbed their bats and ran after witnessing what Eddie Fainer did to the first six batters. Yes, all these major leaguers thought they could play, wait for it, hardball with Fainer just when they realized Fainer was not lobbing them softballs. And just to put a Fainer point on things, Fainer point, all right, this has been a very busy journal. Fainer died in Robin's home state of Alabama. Yes, they buried the man with the rocket arm right by the Rocket Museum in Huntsville, Alabama. Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. And speaking of consecutive strikeouts and Carl Hubble, in the 1934 All-Star Game in the Polo Grounds, Carl Hubble struck out Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Jimmy Fox, Al Simmons, and Joe Cronin, all in a row. A titanic achievement. And this has been Joey's Journal for Titanic Tuesday, the 4th day of May, with Giraffery grabbing a bat so he can take a swing at the right wing. And, yes, again, May the 4th. Be with you. Yep. And consequently, there's a $20 swing at the right wing challenge on the table, and that will get us down to
That would get us down to $260 for the fundraising goal for this evening. If somebody would like to see their $20 doubled, or two people would like to see their $10 doubled, or four people would like to see their $5 doubled. And thank you very kindly to Frank in Iowa. Your matching challenge was, I was at the mailbox today, and that was there, and that was lovely. Thank you. I'll be depositing that post-haste. And so, a couple of things, just to get us started, because I had meant to bring this into the conversation previously. I had a note from Ron in Raleigh. Woke doesn't mean what white folks think it means. There was an interview, Ron in Raleigh points out, between Chris Cuomo and James Carville. And Old Snakehead, that's what his wife calls James Carville, by the way. Old Snakehead says that the Democratic Party has a woke-ism problem. And the interview, well, you can read it over at wokeness is a problem, and we all know it. James Carville on the state of Democratic politics. And the article is by Sean Illing, who writes, I called James Carville hoping to get his thoughts on President Biden's first 100 days in office. He obliged. And then one question in brushed aside the exercise to talk instead about why the Democrats might be poised to squander their political advantage against a damaged GOP. His failure to cooperate may have been for the best, since the first 100 days ritual can sometimes lead to dull, dutiful analysis. What Carville offered up instead was a blunt critique of his own party, even after a successful 2020 election cycle, a sequel of sorts to his fulminations during last year's Democratic primaries. The longtime Democratic strategist is mostly pleased with Biden, but it's where much of the party seems to be going that has him worried. And the poll quote, and what caused a great deal of Sturm und Drang, is his statement that wokeness is a problem, and we all know it. I don't like nominating nominally Democrats on Titanic Tuesday for their Titanic intellects. But that's what Titanic Tuesday is for. Taking note of manifestations of Titanic intellect of the sort that hollers flank speed, all engines full, toward that there iceberg, we're going to show it a thing or two. We spent the four nightmare years from 2017 to 2021 mostly pointing out the idiocy of the Trump administration, but I'm glad Ron and Raleigh chose to bring this to mind, because it don't get much more Titanic than this. Yeah, wokeness is a problem, and we all know it. And then he begins complaining about faculty lounge politics. And he has a white grievance list. They come up with a word like the faculty lounge. They come up with a word like Latinx that no one else uses. Or they use a phrase like communities of color. I don't know. I don't know anyone who speaks like that, Carville said. I don't know anyone who lives in a community of color. I bet you don't, Jimmy. I know lots of black and white and brown people, and they all live in neighborhoods. Well, there is a word in English, and that word is community, and there's another word in English, and it's a possessive preposition, of, it denotes possession. And there's another word in English called color, and that too is a noun. And you can actually string them together, and you can say communities of color, and you don't have to have a corduroy jacket with the leather patches on the elbows and an old, well-worn, broken-in meerschaum pipe, to use the term. It's not how voters talk, James Carville said. Well, how about that? Curiously enough, I am not a member of any faculty, and yet I've used communities of color, I think, on a number of occasions on this program. Occasions. Not how voters talk, not how people talk, and doing it anyway is a signal that you're talking one language and the people you want to vote for are speaking another language. And it ain't harmless, old Snakehead went on to say. And then in his inestimable whiteness, Carville went on to say, we'll have to talk about race. We should talk about racial injustice. What I'm seeing is we need to do it without using jargony language that's unrecognizable to most people, including most black people, by the way. I do love it when folks like James Carville decide to step up to the plate, speak for the communities of color. Because the signals you're trying to talk around them, this too cool for school shit doesn't work, and we have to stop it. There may be a group within the Democratic Party that lacks this, but it ain't the majority. And beyond that, if Democrats want power, they have to win in a country where 18% of the population controls 52% of the Senate seats. That's a fact. That's not changing. That's what this whole damn thing is about. And out of that, the interviewer, Sean Illing, got, sounds like you've got a problem with wokeness. You know what I got a problem with? One of the two institutions of a bicameral legislative system that is founded on notions of non-democracy. Because when a body is, when 18% of the population controls 52% of the Senate seats, that is really and for truly not a democratic institution. It might be oligarchic, it might be plutocratic, but democratic, it ain't. And of course, that's a system, that's a Senate that was created in large part to pacify a bunch of pasty-faced, doughy old, genteel Southern slave owners. And so then he said, wokeness is a problem and everyone knows it. It's hard to talk to anybody today, and I talk to lots of people in the Democratic Party who doesn't see this, but they don't want to see it out loud, because they'll get clobbered or canceled. And so there's James Carville, Titanic Intellect nominee for this fourth day of May, 2021. Adopting a right-wing talking point and advancing it as his own. Cancel culture! Cancel culture is all over the place! Mm-hmm. Lots of Democrats will say that we have to listen to everybody and we have to include every perspective, or that we don't have to run a ruthless messaging campaign. Well, you kind of do. It really matters. I always tell people that we've got to stop speaking Hebrew and start speaking Yiddish. Oy, gewalt. I think that's Yiddish. I did that for effect. Yeah, and I guess old James, he's charming. He's charming. Mm-hmm. And goes on to damn with faint praise people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with the old racist slur. She's obviously very bright. She knows how to draw a headline. And compares her, no shit, to Marjorie Trader Green Cucumber. and said, you know, she's absolutely loonier than a toon. We all know it. And yet, for some reason, the Democrats pay a bigger political price for AOC than Republicans pay for Green. Well, I wonder why that is. Could it be because the multimillionaire for-profit media puts it out there that way? At least he does say it's ridiculous because AOC and Green are not comparable in any way. And so I guess we're supposed to stop using the term woke, although, to be quite candid, that has never become a happening with me. That's never become a thing that I know. And frankly, I don't know many people who use woke. Woke is an appropriated term. It was coined inside a community of color. Sorry, Jimmy. To describe political awareness of a broader range of sensitivities. And because it did not coincide, we talked about this a little bit, but it deserves a bit more elaboration. Because it didn't coincide with the White Wing's version of their dream for America, namely, an America that is still lily white and controlled by the lily white, and even if lily white got down to 18% of the country, they still want it to control the majority of the government. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how so many of the things we've talked about on this program, Carville gets outright wrong. We can't say Republicans are going to call us socialists no matter what, so let's just run as out-and-out socialists. Well, that's not the smartest thing to do. I've actually made that argument before. I think a little bit more coherently and elegantly, but I've made that argument before. We wouldn't be where we are if we hadn't given the Republicans the word socialist to beat us to death with every time we come up with an idea. What? Joe Biden wants all the little kids to have child care and wants parents to stay home with their newborns? Oh, my God. Socialism, socialism. They're going to eat your Bible. And so it goes on from there, because James Carville is deemed to be some sort of political Svengali. And so it is that Ron in Raleigh writes, Carville claims that nobody in Northern Virginia and other conservatives campaigning on defund the police and open borders was the problem, and that being woke was essentially about being anti-white. None of the progressives ran on either of these Republican talking points. As I stated previously, James Carville is saying, don't make white people feel bad. What's happened since 2015 is that white people in the political arena and the rank and file have taken memes like being woke or politically correct and identity politics and turned them on their heads and made them into pejoratives. Carville's doing what the Democrats have been doing for years, in that he is adopting Republican narratives. The Biden administration will achieve no lasting effect on the country because the likes of Manchin, Sinema, Coons, Warner, and others keep chipping away at any efforts to move the country. The next midterms will be a debacle for the Democratic Party, and whatever minor achievements the Biden administration will be rolled back. We're witnessing the beginning of the end of the American experiment. And while he doesn't say it directly, I would argue, Ron, that beginning of the end is sort of a slow-rolling thing. They tend to be generational in this country. And consequently, take a long time. But the term woke and the misuse of it primarily by the for-profit media, is a deliberate attempt to water down the problems that we have. I mean, for Christ's sakes, identity politics, that phrase, and we spend a lot of time with language on this program. Identity politics? Well, that was turned into a complaint to say that there was an attempt at too much inclusion in the Democratic Party, and you know, we just got to do it. We got to do it the power structure's way. Identity politics is another way of saying civil rights. And I guess, I can't be sure, but I guess that maybe identity politics is something to be complained about, say, in regard to, Joe Biden actually acknowledging that underserved and marginalized communities, like the one I recently joined, exist. Because America would be, so much more comfortable if they just didn't have to think about them. White America doesn't like to think about anything but white America. And that is not, and I'm not talking about the members, the men and women of all, from all walks of life of this community. I'm speaking generally. They don't like to be reminded of the rather troubling history of this country, because it is from jump, as I referenced the other night, beginning even before the Anglo culture got here, beginning before the English, beginning before the Dutch, not including the Dutch in Anglo culture, of course. But beginning with the Spanish and the Portuguese, who shed blood that ran like rivers on this continent. But I dare and defy you to find a high school American history course that will talk about the predatory behavior of DeSoto in his and his band of thugs' wanderings around the southeastern, what is now United States. You might get a sanitized version of DeSoto. DeSoto was the first white man to set eyes on the Mississippi. No, he was dead by then. They landed in Florida looking for gold because, well, that was kind of the purpose. Once they found out there was some in Mexico and gold and silver in Peru, or the Andes more properly, there was no Peru. They found massive cities that were beyond the capability of any European culture to build. And they were gonna turn this place upside down and shake it down. Turn the peoples over and shake them down, looking for the aforementioned gold. And in that search, they shed rivers of blood. You will not hear that. If you take a tour, assuming it reopens, if you take a tour of the capital of the United States, you will eventually pass through the rotunda. And you'll see, for instance, the great wall, the portrait on the wall of the baptism of Pocahontas, which is an extremely sanitized thing. The indigenous peoples maintain a memory to this day of the rape of Pocahontas, not the marriage. And there's a portrait of DeSoto, who was already dead, discovering the Mississippi River. Now, I'm sure a Republican would call it cancel culture, but I think those two entirely bullshit representations
of what was deemed to be American history need to be in a museum somewhere and not in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. The imagery and the iconography of it, A, is false, as in not even vaguely reflecting reality beyond the fact that there was a guy named DeSoto and a woman named Pocahontas, but is not integral to the foundation of this country. That famous portrait of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, that hangs in the rotunda as well. But I guess I'm too woke, because I actually know the history of this country. And I know how bloody it is. And I know how horrifying it is. And hey, I'm from the culture that did the bloodletting, that did the invading, that did the stealing. And I sit here in a direct line from people who themselves did some of that very stealing. My McClung and Kincaid ancestors came here and stole the land fair and square in Appalachia. And so I think I'm at least entitled, if not, you know, degreed qualified to talk about it. And it drives white folks who aren't woke batshit crazy. But it plays into everything we are. And if I understand it correctly, wokeness is merely an acknowledgement that there is a history of this country that is largely untold, and that we need to be open to it, and we need to teach it, and we need to know it, and we need to share it, and we need to go forward being a better country, knowing how bad we have been. Is that so goddamn hard? I meant to get to it on last night's program for Moran Monday, but we got along into the program a little too far. Kind of got lost in it. And so this story went by the boards, but lo and behold, thanks to Ron and Raleigh, it remains relevant. Let us go out to Eureka, Missouri. Okay? Where there was a parents' meeting in the school system in which they had a hissy about the 1619 project that would teach critical race theory. And maybe that's another, maybe James Carville's right. Maybe we need to stop calling things by these academic-y, smarty-pants people-sounding names. Because critical race theory probably has no more meaning to an average white high school kid parent in Eureka, Missouri, than does neoliberalism, which we have established in the past used to have an actual meaning within economic terms, but now just means anybody who ever brought a cup of coffee to Bernie Sanders that was too hot, too cold, that was black and didn't have any cream, or that had too much cream and wasn't black, or didn't have sugar, or did have sugar, that person is now a neoliberal establishment shill. Yeah, and to that extent, James Carville is right. And so, too, with critical race theory. Because, see, here's the little secret. Critical race theory is not being taught in the schools of Eureka, Missouri, at all. Not even a little bit. But try to tell that to the And you know, we talk about Emery and Marveline sitting on their matching Barca loungers in their trailer at the Ballerina Swan Lake Country Club and Trailer Park. And Emery and Marveline are generally understood as avatars of Fox viewerness in this community, as, you know, probably being in their, low to mid-80s. And they are kept in a state of constant and persistent dudgeon and terror by people like, you know, Cucky Tucky Carlson over on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda. Or maybe Greg Stinkfield over at Newsmuck. Or Seb Gurkin, whatever his name is, over at Onan, the network that spills its news upon the ground. Their only purpose in life is to keep people rot over shit that they don't understand because they're damn sure not going to explain it to them. And so, with no evidence whatsoever of the teaching of critical race theory or the 1619 Project, people in Eureka, Missouri, got all hot and bothered and all head up because they didn't want anybody teaching that we ever done nothing bad to the black people. And besides, it's all over with because, you know, we lost the Civil War and we took our lumps and now we're going to move on. Don't say move on. And so this was the moment when a Karen arose in Eureka, Missouri, to complain about the teaching of critical race theory. It works a lot better if one actually... Oh, hold on.
Joe stopping drama.
I can hear that you off.
Yeah, I'm off.
Watch ordinary get flipped into extraordinary.
Yeah, damn it. Hold on. Where is it? There it is. That was an ad. So let's try this again.
Not one critical race.
There we go. You can already tell. You can hear the plaintive tones of the Karen's cry. It's not a mating cry, but still.
Just because I do not want critical race theory taught to my children in school does not mean that I'm a racist, damn it. Just because...
Yeah, and, well, the clip cuts off there because it's just a 10-second affair. But you can hear the first of a whole bunch of... You go, girl! Just because you don't want critical race theory taught doesn't mean you're a racist. Kinda does. I want my children taught that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue and there wasn't anybody here. And we landed here and we built a shining city on a hill. Okay, I don't know that phrase either. And we didn't slaughter and genocide the Indians and we didn't have nothing to do with no slavery and even if we did, it's over and we need to get past it and get on with it. Yeah. And if you walked up to Karen here and said, okay, ma'am, we understand that you're upset about critical race theory. Could you tell us what it means, that term? No, I just don't want my children being taught it none. I want them to come to school and stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance and pledge to believe in God like it says. And I want them to know that the Constitution says that everybody in America is a Christian and it's a Christian nation like I done heard on the Onan. Fuck. And as one person commented on the clip, you know, technically she's right. Opposing critical race theory doesn't make her a racist. Being a racist makes her oppose critical race theory. But I've got a solution to this. How about we tell the people of the new 90 states of Merca that good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, gun-dementalist, homosexual, white, Christian, Republican parents don't have to worry about their precious lumpkins ever being taught no critical race theory, and for God's sakes, don't send them to no colleges where they might hear it. We're just not going to have none of it. And then just actually teach the history of the United States and of the colonization of the Western Hemisphere. We can start with the Taino people, you know, who Columbus wrote about in his diary, in his journals, and talked about how sweet and kind and giving and decent they were, and said they will make, as a result, excellent slaves. Or the woman that one of Columbus's officers brought aboard the Nina or the Pinta or the Santa Maria and raped 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 and raped. Can we teach them that? And see, here's another element of the fundamental problem with which we're dealing. And that is this. And as Brother Deacon Asa points out, come on, Robin, we all know critical race theory means we all have to be critical of the white race. You ain't fooling nobody. And adding that woke is mostly used by the maggots when they're trying to shit on anyone to the left of Genghis Khan. Both absolutely true statements. But the biggest problem here, and the reason the conversation is taking place in regard or with reference to public schools, is that, you know, so many kids don't go into higher education, especially now that we've rewired higher education to make sure that so many kids don't go into it. There used to be a time, starting with, say, the Morrill Act of 1862, when we had this idea that it would be good if more American citizens had higher education. Well, okay, more white American citizens. More white male American citizens. But you get the idea. I was listening. I had to be on the road today, and I love the little pieces of history that you get. And I know, there are people in this community that don't like history. But that's okay, because it's really cool to learn it. I heard about a composer whose last name was Det. His first name was Robert. And in 1908, he became the first man of color to graduate from the Oberlin College Conservatory of Music. And on performance today, they went on to play a beautiful piece that he had written about magnolias, that he wrote while he was a professor of music at Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee. And that just caused me, because history, to think about because the music was absolutely breathtaking. It was a piano piece. And as I drove along, I just followed the music in my mind. I mean, I can't read music. But I could, whatever it is that music does to the human spirit, it did it to me. Because one of the things he said about the magnolias, you know, which is it's a quintessentially Southern tree, is I think that they were sad in their beauty or beautiful in their sadness. And I thought about in 1918, in Jackson, Tennessee, and I know Jackson, Tennessee. Oddly enough, it's not that far at all from a magnificent indigenous American city that had some sort of a life all the way from about, you know, one of the common era for the next 1,000 years or so and up into the immediate pre-Columbian era in North America. So I remember that neck of the woods. And that, as I listened to that beautiful music, I thought about the manifest indignities that that man must have had to deal with on a daily basis. They didn't talk about any of that on NPR or American Public Media or whoever the hell produces it. Because white America does not like being reminded of that. When I think we should be reminded of it every goddamn day. And like I said, the reason that this is a discussion about the 1619 Project or critical race theory, which she couldn't define if there was a gun held to her head and if she didn't give the right answer, she was a goner. She'd be a goner. Liberal talk show host says right-wingers who don't want critical race theory should be executed. Oh, Jesus, please. But the reason this matters is because if you don't teach it in high school, if you don't teach it somewhere along the way in the secondary school's curriculum, most people will never even know it. Because, see, if you decide that you want to go to Busted Knuckle State and get yourself one of those 2-year degrees so that you can participate in the coming green energy economy and learn how to work on wind turbines and solar panels and shit, yeah, you're probably not going to take Introduction to American History. And even if you take Introduction to American History, you're probably not going to hear anything about critical race theory or anything else along those lines, because we're going to hold that shit back for the people who get into the 200 and 300 and 400 levels of American history. In a lot of parts of this country. Some parts, not so much. You know, this reminds me of, it was long and long ago, I had our dear friend Jeff Biggers on the program to talk about an effort underway in Arizona at the time to make sure that Latinx, to use a word that James Carville hates, Latinx history and indigenous history and black history were damned well not going to be taught in the public schools of Arizona. In other words, that history was going to be erased. See, these poor, pathetic, delicate, fragile, aggrieved white folks will riot in the streets of Charlottesville and kill people if you try to take down a statue of a man who committed treason against the United States of America and claim that history is being erased, and turn around and go to a school board meeting in Eureka, Missouri, and say they don't want American history taught to American students, which is the actual erasure of history. Because, I mean, if you just get all hot and bothered and damp in your maiden forms about statues of Confederate generals, you could probably go to a museum and see them. Maybe even make a special trip out of it. See all kinds of treasonous old white men. But if your kids can't even be taught something in school, they're never going to know there was ever a problem. And that way lies, as Ron and Raleigh pointed out, the failure of the American experiment. And so, you know, my idea would be to go to, you know, damn near on the point of tears, white lady in Eureka, Missouri, and say, okay, calm down, it's all right. Here, here's it. here's a gift certificate for Bed Bath & Beyond. That'll make you feel all better, won't it? Here's another gift certificate for Longa Burger Baskets. And here's a gift certificate for some home interior cheap bric-a-brac. Now, don't you worry your little punkin' head, honey. We're not going to teach critical race theory, and we're not going to teach the 1619 Project. But what we are going to do is we're going to teach American history. We're going to teach American history unvarnished and unfly-blown in its truth. And we're going to talk about how America got to be America. Is that okay?
Okay. Longa Burger Baskets, I always wanted one of those. Real expensive. Husband won't let me buy any.
But we're going to teach... But you're still okay. We're going to teach him...
Oh, yeah, I don't give a goddamn.
And then you teach American history, and then maybe we can make some goddamn progress. We're still teaching that the Senate of the United States is an exercise in democracy. I know this for a fact. And I know people who have taught that the Senate of the United States is a democratic institution. When it is not, we seek to reform the Senate of the United States not because it is democratic, but because it is not. Sorry, couldn't help myself. But... Just remember, a grieved Karen there in Eureka, Missouri. Well,
just because I do not want critical race theory taught to my children in school does not mean that I'm a racist, damn it.
Damn it! Damn it!
This is one of those moments when it would be handy to have a loop of Scott in San Diego saying, "We're all screwed, Robin." Mm-hmm. And so I hope Ron and Raleigh is wrong in his grim assessment that the Biden administration will achieve nothing of lasting import. I think they already have. Just trying to get a handle on the virus is a big deal, and they've made tremendous strides. And I think we will make further strides. Going back to early Western Hemisphere history, Flavio points out, when local people who lived along the coast resisted his invasion, Francisco Pizarro moved inland and founded the first Spanish settlement in Peru, San Miguel de Piura. After a series of maneuvers, Pizarro captured the Incan Emperor Atahualpa at the Battle of Cajamarca in November 1532. A ransom for the emperor's release was demanded, and Atahualpa filled a room with gold, but Pizarro charged him with various crimes and executed him. In July 1533, the same year, Pizarro entered the Inca capital of Cusco and completed his conquest of Peru. Mm-hmm. And Cusco was a city built of stones that a white European could not have begun to comprehend the techniques by which they were built. And in fact, to this day, we're not so good on that topic. And as far as identity politics is concerned, Ron and Raleigh points out the phrase was coined by Barbara Smith in 1972. Ms. Smith and other black feminists felt that the feminism espoused by white feminists did not suit their condition, so Ms. Smith and other black feminists used the phrase to describe their take on feminist philosophy. Yeah. It's been around since 1972. But the centrists out there of the Democratic Party will tell you, we can't have identity politics! And out of what Ms. Smith, Dr. Smith, and others were talking about, arose the idea of intersectionalism, where an ism isn't only an ism, it is an ism that is formed and shaped by the intersection of multiple disciplines and multiple ideas. By the way, Ron and Raleigh asked, did you hear that Oberfuhrer Stephen Miller is going to sue the Biden administration because of a $5 billion set aside in the recovery bill for minority farmers who've been and are still being fucked over by the USDA? Sonder Commando Capo Steve believes that because of the small set-aside, white men are being discriminated against. Okay, let's call them reparations then. That'll just make his head explode. What I'm trying to figure out, and I heard a Biden administration official this morning on my filthy morning habit mention the unutterable horrors at the border that were committed during the nightmare years of the Trump maladministration. And the thing that popped into my head was, and why haven't any of these assholes been charged with crimes? What they did was illegal. But Stephen Miller, the capo, yet walks free. Silent R. Lamar the Magnificent, pointing out, if you get it, I said it once again, I'll say it again. If you don't like woke, then you should have let us stay asleep. As far as cancel culture, Lamar says, yeah, I got a problem with cancel culture when your people are being canceled by the police. Jesus, just by way of an ending, I remember when the word gay meant you were happy. Shit, just stop the world and let me off. Yeah, it kind of brings into focus it, a little bouquet of flowers is known as a nosegay. Sorry, that just brought a little smile to my face. Thank you, Lee in New York. Yes, Oy Gewalt is Yiddish. So there I am, unwittingly, it was witting, following James Carville's advice. And as to Joey's journal, Ron Raleigh points out, I believe that Joey has insulted the Hutts. The Hutts are a family crime syndicate that were a very successful crime family. The Trumps are just lucky so far. All right, fair enough. And Ron and Raleigh, again, may the 4th be with you. Yes. So there are, and I don't know, hopefully I don't get an email complaining about me spending an hour on this, but I think it bears mention. And, look, there are lots of programs out there that will talk about all the minutiae of the day-to-day. I like the deep background stuff. I like the broad form conversation. Just be glad, because now our dear friend Rico into the Wondrous Berg has planted the idea in my tiny little noggin that somehow or another I need to work up a 3-hour filibuster on dryer lint. Oh dear God. Maybe we'll save that for a fill-in program for one day when Agnes can't drag me in from a lovely summer's day. But Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington made a bit of a splash. They had a press release based on an order from a U.S. district judge. Thanks, Dave, number 11, for sending this along, and thanks to Sparky for pointing it out as well. A federal judge has ordered the Department of Justice to turn over a memo cited by then-Attorney General Bill Barr as his reasoning not to charge President Trump with obstruction of justice as part of a lawsuit brought by Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW. CREW notes, when Barr delivered the Mueller report to Congress, he said that there was not sufficient evidence to charge Trump, a decision made, quote, in consultation with the Office of Legal Counsel and other department lawyers, unquote. Barr and the Department of Justice have refused to turn over the OLC memo, which led to the lawsuit from CREW. And Judge Amy Berman Jackson, and I will dare say, maybe this will come back to haunt me, I hope not, may she live long and prosper, and may the 4th be with her, She held in an opinion that the contents of that memo, quote, call into question the accuracy of Attorney General Barr's March 24th representation to Congress, particularly the bogus assertion that Mueller left it up to the Attorney General to determine whether the conduct his report described was a crime, and went on to say that the Office of Legal Counsel's description of the document, quote, served to obscure the true purpose of the memorandum, and the true purpose of the memorandum, according to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington crew, was to provide cover for Bill Barr to prosecution, you know, Attorney General Pepe the Frog. And the and Judge Jackson held the memo raises serious questions about how the Department of Justice could make this series of representations to a court. It's time for the public to see that memo too. And she gave the government 2 weeks to respond, and hopefully Attorney General Merrick Garland will look at it and say, we'll turn it loose, and there won't be any further Sturm und Drang over it. What does this mean? Well, in the short run, it means that we're going to get to, unless Merrick Garland turns out to be much less of an ethical human being than I think he is, we're going to get to see this piece of legalistic legerdemain that was behind Attorney General Pepe the Frog and his decision to dummy up the Mueller report. So 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today. Let's see, that would be May the 18th. Watch this space. But that kind of goes hand in glove with another allegation that has reached the public consciousness. According to a news story in the Telegraph of the UK, there wasn't just one Steele dossier. There were two. And that even after he had produced the first dossier and turned it over, he continued to investigate allegations of sexy time shenanigans, maybe crimes, of Donald J. Trump in Mother Russia. In the newspaper account, it reads, Mr. Steele's continued involvement supplying intelligence to the FBI appears to give credibility to his original dossier, which sparked a special counsel investigation by prosecutor Robert Mueller into Russian interference into the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. And along the way mentioned the PP tape, which I continue to allege and assert very likely is still in existence and under the care, custody, and control of huggable, lovable, snuggleable, cuddleable Vlad Putin, who wouldn't hurt a fly as long as the fly was doing his bidding. But otherwise might very well poison the fly with a deadly neurotoxin or a little polonium particle in an umbrella tip. The news story continues, the second dossier contains raw intelligence that makes further claims of Russian meddling in the U.S. election and also references claims regarding the existence of further sex tapes. The second dossier is reliant on separate sources to those who supplied information for the first reports. Because, you see, that's one of the fundamental problems of an autocratic dictatorship. They rely to a great degree on being able to clamp down on information, and consequently that turns them immediately into a paranoia state, a paranoid state. And that means there's an even greater likelihood that eventually, the information's going to get out. The article continues, the fact that the FBI continued to receive intelligence from Mr. Steele, who ran MI6's Russia desk from 2006 to 2009 before setting up Orbis, a company, is potentially significant because it shows his work was apparently still being taken seriously after Mr. Trump took hold of the reins of power. The suggestion it includes further details of Mr. Trump's sexual exploits or deviances or disgusting practices, I don't know, will infuriate the former president. On Twitter, he has called the allegations a pile of garbage. But here's the interesting thing. Way, way back when the first Steele dossier came out, we started talking about something that was being whispered on low levels here and there. Namely, the fact that there were other Sexy Time tapes, and it wasn't just a matter of a tape of Donald Trump, which was actually not sex. The PP tape is not a sex tape. To the extent that America even knows about the PP tape, mostly they know the wrong thing. They think it involves some sort of golden shower scenario. Yep, there we are, 6 minutes into the second hour of the program, and there went dinner in the Central Daylight Time Zone. Sorry. But that wasn't what it was about at all. The allegation in the Steele dossier was that Donald J. Trump, and J does in fact stand for Java, Donald J. Trump paid Russian hookers to come to the presidential suite at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Moscow to the room where Barack Obama and Michelle Obama had laid their weary heads to sleep and paid them to urinate in Trump's presence on that bed.
That shows them. I just wanted to say, because that's what I'd like to do to Obama and his wife. You know, because melanoma won't let me do that to her. I've asked. I even offered to pay. She said,
Donald, I know check will not be good. It will bounce to moon. You're broke.
Nah, maybe not. But the thing is, when all the PP tape stuff was going around, if you recall, there was mention made of the fact that there were other tapes. And while the PP tape was made in glorious Moscow, capital of Mother Russia, these tapes were made in St. Petersburg, it was said. And rather than featuring Nitwit Nero watching hookers go pee-pee, that these tapes instead featured something far, far worse. Because there was actual Sexy Time involved. And that the Sexy Time involved Donald J. Trump having sex with underage girls. You know, just like Matt Gaetz. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, shortly thereafter, and I don't know why this was never, I don't know why these lines, these dots were never connected. But shortly thereafter, we began to hear the stories of Jeffrey Epstein and how Ghislaine Maxwell, who was both procurer and girlfriend, would go out and find comely young maidens whom she would pander to have sex with Jeffrey Epstein and his many skeevy, pervy, rapey pals on Epstein Island in the Caribbean. and how, in fact, among those friends of Mr. Epstein was Donald J. Trump. And that, in fact, there was video of a really, really groovy, groovy baby, Donald J. Trump, standing next to Jeffrey Epstein and just, you know, boogieing and pointing at the little lissom nymphets and pointing out which ones would be most fuckable. Because, you know, that is what sexual predators like Jeffrey Epstein and Donald Trump do. Right? Yeah. One, Brother Deacon Asa says, just call them Trump's sexcapades. Two, can you imagine how the maggots are going to cream their pants when they finally get to watch some underage Russian hookers gobbing on Trump's mushroom-shaped cone? Oh, Brother Deacon, and you gave me shit last night for what I said about a... never mind, I'm not going to repeat it. Yep. Anybody in the Central Daylight Time Zone who was actually dining and had a thought toward maybe continuing the meal in the hopes that it wouldn't get worse has now pushed the plate away, pushed back from the table, and said, fuck it, I'm out of here. Yeah, they're going to go wild. I wonder if his handlers down in Mar-a-Lago will be able to keep him from mentioning Steele Dossier 2.0. Because, you know, he has this habit of addressing things that should really be sort of, you know, left unsaid. Matt in San Francisco pointing out, if the PP tape comes to light, if it ever goes public, there will be just a sharp increase in mattress sales in the southern states, as his followers will no doubt purchase Serta Perfect sleepers and hold public events where red MAGA hat-wearing women pee on the mattresses. There's no end to their depravity, I know. And Matt, you're so right. Although I will offer a bit of an edit or a caveat. No, Mr. Pillow, Mike Lindell, will go into the mattress business if he isn't already. And he'll, this is my mattress. My mattress is perfect for peeing on. And you can pee on the mattress while I explain to you the secret knowledge that I have of how the election was stolen. But you'll have to tune in to my website, which is going to be a competitor for Amazon, to find out how. Yeah. You know, they'll do it. They'll do it. Because it's who they are. Isn't it terrible, Matt, when you can just predict what they're going to do? Because somehow or another, as unpleasant as it is, you figured out a way to sort of channel them and get inside their mindset for a minute. And then once you've gotten inside their mindset for a minute, the next thing you have to do is go and take that that shower with brain bleach. Yeah. Oh, and Darlene in Connecticut said, I'm sorry, where did you find this article? I arrived at this fascinating story late. It's over at the Telegraph, UK. Let me see, how's it slugged? Former MI6 spy produced a second Trump dossier for the FBI. That's it. The story is by Robert Mendick and Lucy Fisher. The former MI6 spy, Christopher Steele, produced a second dossier for the FBI on Donald Trump while he was in the White House, sources have told the Daily Telegraph. And, of course, immediately the maggots began hollering. Well, there wasn't no truth to the first Steele dossier. Why are we talking about second Steele dossier? Well, there was... It's amazing the degree to which the contents of the first Steele dossier were actually shown to be true. The fact that Vlad hung on to the PP tape tells us a lot more about its value to Vlad, and I think Nitwit Nero proved that repeatedly, than anything. You see what I'm saying? And yes, Darlene, I know it's pronounced Ghislaine Maxwell. LOL. How? I don't know. Ghislaine. And it's Ghislaine. Nah, I'm sorry. I'm a hillbilly. I'm gonna pronounce it like it looks. And the goddess of irony demands no less, and consequently it is Ghislaine Maxwell. Darlene. So no shit. There was another Steele dossier. This is the stuff of movies. How will the Republicans spin that one? Well, the way there was, he done said the first one was garbage, and he never told a single lie, so we gonna believe him too. On that, gerp, darp, nerb, gerbil. Oh, wait a minute. That's for Jeremy in Vermont. Mike, Mr. Pillow Lindell, when he becomes Mr. Mattress, he will refer to the product as methdresses. Methdresses. That's quality. That's very, very good indeed. And hence the cowbell, Jeremy. Yeah, Randy Radar's right. The billionaires seem to have a rapey problem. What do you do when you're an asshole with too much money? You turn to sex. We've seen it time and again. Think about the gambling problems of various multimillionaire. Think about the guy who wrote the Book of Virtues, sitting naked in his hotel room with a bag of Cheetos and a computer slot machine, lecturing America. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I remember that shit all too well. That goes all the way back to what? 16, 17 years ago. Yeah. I've got this story in the stack, but Flavio's ahead of me. Why should I have to hear about 1619? I didn't enslave nobody. Well, this story out of South Carolina, Stan. Conway, South Carolina is the location. And there's a man now doing time. His name, Bobby Paul Edwards, at age 56, was sent to prison for 10 years, and a court ordered him to pay back John Christopher Smith $273,000 in unpaid wages and overtime compensation at J&J Cafeteria, because Bobby Paul Edwards of Conway, South Carolina, at the J&J Cafeteria, enslaved John Christopher Smith for 5 years. And in fact, the court has held that no, he doesn't owe him just the back wages and back pay. He owes him double back pay. And in a ruling on April the 21st, the Circuit Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit said that the district court had erred in not accounting for federal labor laws entitling him to $546,000, or double the amount he was owed, from his enslavement between 2009 and 2014. And, of course, Bobby Paul Edwards, well, he enslaved Christopher John Smith, or John Christopher Smith, by... using physical violence, that means hurting him, a man with intellectual disabilities and special needs. By hurting him, threatening him, and intimidating him. And worked him for 100 hours a week without pay. Well, hell, that's heritage, not hate. And what the court pointed out is when an employer fails to pay those amounts, regular and overtime pay, the employee suffers losses, which includes the loss of the use of that money during that the period of delay. It was 1990. And see, this is the problem with almost any labor-based complaint about pay. It takes for damn ever to get pay, and that's how the ownership class wins. Mr. Smith started washing dishes and bussing tables at J&J Cafeteria in 1990. At that time, he was 12 years old. And at that point in time, Edward's relatives ran the J&J Cafeteria in Conway, South Carolina. Because, of course, it's South Carolina. He worked full-time, and he loved it. And he was apparently well-treated by Edward's kinfolk. And Edward's kinfolk paid young Mr. Smith. But in 2009, Mr. Smith took over running the J&J Cafeteria of Conway, South Carolina. And that's when everything changed for young Mr. Smith. And once again, with this, the historical echoes, one of the things that you will hear defenders of the Old South say is, well, they had to feed and clothe and doctor and take care of them slaves. I mean, they got treated better than they did when they moved up north and went to work. Yeah, except for the fact that when they moved up north and went to work, they were free! Because it's not like you know, old Morris, I'm tired. I think I can get a better deal being a slave on the other planet. Jesus Christ. I'm just going to go over there and enslave myself over there for a while. And not making light. Well, they had to feed them. And they treated them real good. And see, here's the thing. Real live, honest to God, Southern Republican politicians have made this argument in public. Who was it? I think dude was from Louisiana. Which one was it, research department? Oh, it was the Duck Dynasty dickhead. It wasn't a politician. It was Duck Doofus. Well, he's all the time out in the cotton fields and the sugar cane patch, chopping and a-singing. They was happy. Of course, because Duck Doofus never studied any history neither, let alone no critical race theory, he didn't realize that the history of music, especially so-called folk music, is a history of responses to oppression. There was a time, for instance, when the English forbade the Irish from singing. And so you get this rich history of the Irish music. Oh, diddle-o, fiddle-o, diddle-o, day. That bullshit. Those nonsense words were protests. And so those happy, oh Jesus. But anyway, Edwards moved Mr. Smith into a roach-infested apartment he owned. And Smith's lawyers would go on to tell the court that it was subhuman, deplorable, harmful to human health. And he worked for 100 hours each week without pay and no days off because he had a cognitive disability. He isolated Smith from his family He threatened to have him arrested, and, of course, because South Carolina, he called him racial slurs. In the record of the proceedings in the court, Mr. Smith said, "Most of the time I felt unsafe, like Bobby could kill me if he wanted. I wanted to get out of that place so bad, but couldn't think about how I could without being hurt." Because Bobby whipped him with belts, beat him with kitchen pans, punched him multiple times. And at one point in time, Bobby thought that Mr. Smith didn't bring the fried chicken to the buffet as quick as he wanted. And so that's when Bobby dipped some metal serving tongs into hot grease and pressed them into young Mr. Smith's neck. And meanwhile, it was going on, and other people working at the restaurant didn't say a goddamn word because, well, they needed the job. Until finally, Janine Keynes, in 2014, who had a daughter-in-law who worked at the J&J cafeteria, dropped the dime. She told WMBF, "Customers that were going in there would hear stuff, and they didn't know what was going on, and they'd ask the waitresses, and the waitresses were so scared of Bobby, they wouldn't tell them then what it was." And that is how the brutality of capitalism, sorry, works. U.S. Attorney for the District of South Carolina, Sherry A. Lydon, said, "For stealing his victim's freedom and wages, Mr. Edwards has earned every day of his sentence. The U.S. Attorney's Office will not tolerate forced or exploitative labor in South Carolina."
Yeah, because South Carolina's fucking union wonderland.
Mm-hmm. "And we are grateful to the watchful citizen and our partners in law enforcement who put a stop to this particularly cruel violence. Particularly, I tell you. Why, it just plumb put me off my shrimp and grits." God, yeah. But remember, heritage, not hate. Oh, and Frank wants to know, how's Rush doing today? Well, my friends, Rush Limbaugh, with the golden EIB microphone crammed somewhere you don't want to know, why, because I'm down here in hell now, is still dead. By the way, Jeremy, you got a big giggle out of Ralph's for mistresses. Hi, I'm Mr. Pillow. Now I want to introduce you to my mistresses. Mistresses. What? And as Flavio points out, not only do they not want to hear about 1619 or critical race theory, they want the return of slavery. Oh, the sun shines. Yeah. When we were watching the Kentucky Derby, and they play, and you know, they get all solemn there, and the men take off their hats at the Kentucky Derby. Of course, the women's don't have to. It's one of the nice things. I don't have to worry about ever uncovering for the national anthem again. Hat's staying on, damn it. But they get all solemn when they play the "My Old Kentucky Home" at the Kentucky Derby. And as an advocate of cancel culture, I think we could probably do away with playing "My Old Kentucky Home." I don't even know the tune. I mean, Stephen Foster wrote "Way Down Upon the Suwannee River" and "The Old Folks at Home," and that, he wasn't talking about white folks. That was another. He spent a lot of time, because Stephen Foster was deeply involved in minstrelsy. And I remember on Saturday looking at one of the folks who was there and said, you know, they really ought to sing it and not just play it. And the folks in the stands do sing it. Oh, the sun shines bright in my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the people are gay. And then there's a talk about, and I think this has been sanitized, because it's got some, let me look for this. There we go. Stephen Foster wrote it in 1853. And it started life, my old Kentucky home, because Stephen Foster had read Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. And the original name of the song was Poor Old Uncle Tom Goodnight. Mm-hmm. The lyrics were revised in 1986. Because they had to be revised. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the state song of Kentucky. Because some argue that, well, goodness me, Stephen Foster was being sympathetic to enslaved peoples. But a Louisville-born historian by the name of Emily Bingham, interviewed by WPFL, said, it was written by a white man about a black person being sold down the river from Kentucky to the Deep South to be sung by white men pretending to be black men on stages for white audiences. It was produced specifically for blackface minstrelsy. Yeah, maybe they might want it. Well, never mind. And the Louisiana lawmaker was State Representative Ray Garofalo, Flavio serving as the Horn Ad Hoc Research Committee. Louisiana State Representative Ray Garofalo said public schools and universities in the state should be required to teach the good of slavery when they discuss race as part of a bill he proposed to ban divisive concepts from classrooms. The committee vote ended up 7-7 because seven people actually thought it was a good idea and it should move to the floor of the Louisiana legislature for further consideration. He's the head, Garofalo was, of the Louisiana House Education Committee. They should talk about everything dealing with slavery, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And he got all worked up talking about it. Mm-hmm. And as Bill said, we can't be a-teaching the idea that the U.S. or Louisiana is systematically racist or sexist. Because, well, heritage, not hate. And as for the story of poor Mr. Smith and Bobby down there in Conway, South Carolina, Jeremy points out, Jesus H. Christ, all this story needs is the ghost of dead Barbara Bush to show us, saying, this is a great outcome for him, with the theme to the Jeffersons playing lightly in the background, moving on up. Jeremy's on a roll this evening. Oh, how do they get my email address? Just somebody tell me. I got so many things. There's just so many little details to sort out, and I'm still hoping we'll eventually have a new intro to the program, et cetera, et cetera. My God. I just got a... Where'd it go? Did I accidentally trash it? Well, that is the damnedest thing. I guess you can recall emails. Because as I was talking, I got an email from the Caitlyn Jenner gubernatorial campaign, and before I could even click, it was gone. And I didn't trash it. Let me check another device. Oh, there it, okay, all right, let's try again. Yeah, it's gone. Son of a gun. Caitlin for California, and it, boop, disappeared. Oh, good, congratulations, good news. Brother Bishop Steve from Georgia Stan, step two vaccination complete. Blobbin. Skeeve! Just wanted to let you know that Miss Karen and me received our second Moderna shot today. I must admit, it feels very liberating. Well, take it, I understand that feeling. See to it, please, Steve, that y'all hydrate liberally. Gatorade's good if you can do it, or Gatorade zero sugar or whatever, depending on what. But get your Gatorade and your water and take your ibuprofen, and hopefully you won't have any untoward after effects. Oh, my God, I'm stuck in my cornpone accent. Whatever shall I do? And again, thank you, Jeremy, for jumping in on Joey and Giraffe's challenge. We got $15 to go on that. Thank you. And we got, well, if we can meet that challenge, and now that we are over halfway through the program, if we could meet that $20 challenge, that would take us down to $260 to go. And gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could? And eat protein. Make sure you got lots of protein in your diet, Randy in PA advises. So congratulations, Steve and Miss Karen. So we're a little over halfway through the program. This is, after all, Conversation Radio, and you're more than welcome to chime in with your thoughts, see where you want to go with the program this evening, because one of the odd things about this program, as Kevin, our buddy Kevin in Massachusetts, alluded to last night, is that we are about the conversation. And if you've got something you've that's just, you know, burr under your saddle, holler. I saw this story from the Wall Street Journal and went, what? Because you know that there is a significant portion of America that's all upset about vaccine passports. I ain't going to have no vaccine passport. You can't make me take Bill Gates' little 5G barcodes into my body where they can attract me everywhere I want to go. And even though I've already been letting them attract me for ever since I put one of them little tiny computers in my pocket, you can't make me do it because freedom. Dateline, London, from the Wall Street Journal, in their business department. Airlines are battling a scourge of passengers traveling with falsified COVID-19 health certificates. The documents are often the COVID-19 test results required by many countries on arrival. The International Air Transport Association industry body says it has tracked fake certificates in multiple countries from France to Brazil, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. Border control authorities and police force... Who's trying to fly to fucking Afghanistan, really? What is it, the Taliban homecoming? Well, yeah, kinda. Border control authorities and police forces have also reported arrests of people selling documents in the UK, Spain, Indonesia, and Zimbabwe, among others. And international flights are being hit more than domestic ones. because most domestic flights don't require a certificate right at the point, at this point in time. And the Wall Street Journal report, and you know, in the Wall Street, it's a Murdoch paper, but some of their straight news reporting, it's not nearly as awful as what happens on their editorial page. But they say that the proliferation of fake health certificates is exposing a logistical blind spot because the airlines are trying to figure out a way how to continue to exist in a post-pandemic world. I don't know. Maybe we do need some little liquid barcodes in there. Boop, 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 boop. Airlines say their staff aren't equipped to handle and police all the new health certifications needed and worry the problem will be exacerbated. You know, it'll grow hair on your palms, that exacerbation. When some countries also start to ask for vaccination certificates in their own right. Staff have at Brussels Airlines have shared fake certificates they've come across. There was an incident just last week. They take out the names of the passengers and then show how they tried to make it look like the real document and the techniques used. That's Brussels Airlines. And you can hear the fulmination of the pre- and post-millennialist evangelical fundamentalists saying, see, it's the mark of the beast. Eventually, they're going to make you get a tattoo. And if I guess it's, you know, the fake passports are a thing, so, well, why wouldn't fake vaccine certifications be there? Sorry for the blipping. Brother Deacon Asa tells me I'm blipping all over the place at 39 past the hour and 41 past the hour. Asa was just slightly ahead of Randy and PA, who says 3-second glitches in stream. Sorry. Wish there was something I could do about it. Yeah, see how post-racist we are, says Flavio in Wisconsin. We've left it so far behind. Yeah, right, sure. And, you know, we kind of breathed a sigh of relief when something like accountability was announced by the jury in the trial of the murderer, Derek Chauvin. Via The Hill, a report that juror in the case, Brandon Mitchell, was photographed at a rally wearing a Black Lives Matter T-shirt. And this will, of course, be fodder for the right wing to go absolutely batshit crazy. And as Darlene in Connecticut points out, oh, geez, you think for 1 second that Chauvin and his attorneys won't use this on appeal? Of course, the proves juror bias is what it proves. Proves that he thinks that Black Lives Matter. And we all know that they don't. And that's why Derek Chauvin had to patriotically kneel on the neck of George Floyd for in excess of 9 minutes. Because Black Lives don't matter. Nauseating. Oh, well, thank you, Jeremy in Vermont. Give yourself a nice, good cowbell for who's flying to Afghanistan. Is it the Taliban homecoming? And I might add, Jeremy says it'll be tax-free. Well, thank you, Jeremy. I take them wherever I can get them. Well, at least I know I don't have to have no faked-up, frauded-up, dummied-up, ginned-up vaccine passport because I got one with me and I carry it in my purse all the time. I never leave home without it. There's a funny. That's a giggle. With the new Nitwit Nero website, he launched Fox News TV Radio Rwanda referred to it as a new platform. No, it's not a new platform. It's a goddamn blog. titled, From the Desk of Donald J. Trump. The best line, Dollar Store Twitter. Oh, that's good. course, you can't respond. $45's new dollar store Twitter. It's going to be his. It's just a petty grievance platform. That's all. And he's out there trying to pump some life into the grift. I don't know. Maybe it's as slow for him as. Never mind. He gave an interview to Candace. Hitler was an okay guy until he started invading other countries. Owens. What was the name she got? What was it? Grifterella? Was that the term we had the other night? She asked Nitwit Nero if he was going to run again in 2024, and he said,
"Well, the answer is I'm absolutely enthused. I look forward to doing an announcement at the right time. As you know, it's very early, but I think people are going to be very, very happy when I make a certain announcement."
Well, that's kind of cagey, isn't it? I'd be very, very happy if he announced that, you know, he wasn't going to run. Apparently, he's raised something on the order of $85 million. But the problem is, if he says he's running, then the PAC laws and the PAC rules say that he can't straight up ask for money for the PAC.
So, you know, because of campaign finance laws, otherwise I think I'd give you an answer you'd be very happy with. So we're looking at that very, very seriously. All I'd say is stay tuned.
Oh, how can we miss you if you won't go away?
Ugh.
But it is Tuesday, and Tuesdays are special because that means we get the Green News Report from Brad and Desi. So let's check it out, and if you've got something you'd like to discuss, talk about, what have you, well, let me know. On Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. Ugh, I really want that to be Robin Kincaid Horn, but never mind. And on the stress line, 844-843-4676, 844-THE-HORN. Either one gets you right into the program. Let's check out Brad and Desi.
21.
There is simply no blades for wind turbines can't be built in Pittsburgh instead of Beijing.
Biden makes history with climate-focused congressional address.
Drilling also releases another potent greenhouse gas, methane.
New report finds reduction of methane crucial for climate. Plus, Washington State passes landmark cap-and-trade law.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
He wants control of your life. He's going to control how much meat you can eat. Can you imagine that?
No, I can't imagine that because it's not true, because you're making it up, Kevin McCarthy, and you know you're making it up because it's been debunked days ago, yet you keep saying it. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, you have been delighted for days about this since Biden's address. It was historic, particularly from a climate perspective.
Indeed it was. President Joe Biden's address to a joint session of Congress on his 99th day in office late last week was historic. For the first time, man-made climate change was woven throughout a State of the Union or equivalent speech as a core part of economic policy, foreign policy, and job creation.
Biden lover.
Biden's climate policies depend heavily on Congress passing his $2 trillion American Jobs Plan proposal to rebuild the nation's crumbling infrastructure and shift to clean energy. He characterized it as crucial to stay competitive with China, which is investing twice as much as the U.S. in clean technology. And he pitched it to union members, a key voting bloc, name-checking the IBEW union, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
American Jobs Plan will put engineers and construction workers to work building more energy-efficient buildings and homes. Electrical workers, IBEW members, installing 500,000 charging stations along our highways so we can own so we can own the electric car market.
Biden's joint address to Congress could mark a turning point for the U.S. and the world if his climate policies are translated into broad action.
Oh, that's a big if.
Indeed it is. On Monday, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell surprised no one in announcing that no Republicans will vote for Biden's jobs plan, no matter what is in it, making West Virginia's conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin an incredibly powerful figure determining the course of future U.S. climate action.
Long may he reign.
Meanwhile, the Transportation Department is moving forward, announcing the administration will jumpstart construction of new interstate electric transmission lines to distribute clean energy across the country, avoiding delays and disputes by siting lines along existing federal rights of ways and highways.
Do you need special electric lines to transmit clean energy versus regular old dirty energy?
Yes, you do, because high voltage transmission lines are way better at carrying energy over really, really long distances.
Huh, who knew?
A new report by the American Council on Renewable Energy has identified 22 shovel-ready grid transmission projects across the country that they say would increase wind and solar generation by 50% in the U.S. and create 1.2 million jobs. In other news, Senate Democrats late last week voted to reinstate Obama-era regulations limiting methane emissions from the oil and gas industry using the Congressional Review Act, which allows Congress a short window to rescind regulations passed by a previous administration.
Well, that's about time, Democrats.
Yes, and it matters, because methane, the principal component in natural gas, is a more potent climate-warming gas than carbon dioxide on shorter timescales, and the oil and gas industry is a primary source. The New York Times reports that a new draft study by the United Nations warns that slashing methane emissions is far more important to slowing man-made global warming than previously thought, and plugging fossil fuel industry leaks has the biggest potential to slow emissions both efficiently and cheaply.
And that is a huge part of the Biden American jobs plan.
Exactly. Moving swiftly to cut human-caused methane emissions from the most polluting industries, fossil fuels, landfills, and agriculture could slow the rate of global warming almost immediately by as much as 30%, buying us some time, and overall would avoid about a third of a degree Celsius of global warming by the 2040s.
It is maddening that these old drilling platforms are leaking methane. They're not even giving us oil or gas. They're just making the climate worse.
And on public lands, they're actually wasting the public's natural gas when they flare it into the atmosphere.
Ah, yes, that too.
And finally, Washington State's Democratic majority state legislature finally passed a bill to establish a cap and trade system to cut the state's carbon emissions. It'll be the second state after California to do so. The system requires polluters to pay for their carbon pollution and will launch in 2023.
Make them pay. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Well, it's always well worthwhile, and it's Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, the fourth day of May. I'm Robin. Where do you want to go? Well, let me know. Give a holler if you wish. Otherwise, there is an absolute plethora. There is an embarrassment of riches in terms of Titanic intellect this evening. Oh, God. Yeah. Let's check in with a couple of stories out of Tennistan. Tennistan is always good for Titanic intellect. This is such a classic case of the degree to which maggots and white wingers cannot, for the life of them, even allow the faintest bit of decency entered their lives. I mean, honestly. Tennistan is the acknowledged home of country music in the United States, and country music probably brings in a shit ton more money than rock and roll does, maybe always has. And Tennistan reverences that. Sorta, kinda, sometimes. And so, one of the more anodyne and innocuous things that legislatures do, especially maggot Republican legislatures, is every now and then they'll pass a resolution honoring somebody for something that they did. So there's a country group out there called the Brothers Osborne. Okay? And the Brothers Osborne are, I guess, reasonably, I don't keep up with the country charts, okay? But a bill was introduced in the legislature of Tennistan that would have honored country music star T.J. Osborne of the Brothers Osborne. Okay. Well, it's because T.J. Osborne came out. T.J. Osborne, who is popular quite, I guess, became the first openly gay country music artist that was signed to a major country music label. And so, there in the Tennessee House of Representatives, they introduced a resolution honoring him for his courage. And, well, enter representing Jeremy Faison, F-A-I-S-O-N. You know, probably piss him off if you pronounced it kind of French, like Jeremy Faison. Don't talk it like that! And he blocked the bill honoring T.J. Osborne. And he said, well, I only blocked it because it had some procedural issues. It hadn't gone through the committee process. See, he's chair of the House Republican Caucus. And he blocked the resolution that would have just been voted on the floor and moved on, whatever, what have you. And instead, sent it to committee, where it can die. The funny thing is, though, the same day, well, you know, there was some procedural problems with this here resolution honoring that homosexual country music star, because, well, one of the procedural issues is that country music shouldn't have no homosexuals in it. No, he didn't say that part. That's just the part he was thinking. But the House had already voted on several bills that had not gone through the committee process, just running through the legislature like shit through a goose. But suddenly, that resolution was a problem, even though it didn't cost the state of Tennessee a damn dime. And, you know, maybe it would have made, say, some tormented little closeted gay kid or kids in Tennessee a little bit of comfort, a little bit of surcease of sorrow. Nope, can't do that, can't have that. But when you realize who representing Faison is, well, it makes a little more sense. He's been polluting the Tennessee legislature because people in his district persist in sending him back to Nashville since at least 2012. And back in 2012, when there was a horrible, horrible outbreak of LGBTQIA plus suicides from bullying, well, representing Faison back then said, well, they didn't die by suicide because of bullying. They suicided themselves because their parents didn't instill the proper principle.
We can't continue to legislate everything. We've had some horrible things happen in America and in our state, and there's children that have actually committed suicide. But I'll submit to you today, they didn't commit suicide because of somebody bullying them. They committed suicide because they were not instilled the proper principles of where their self-esteem came from at home. In other words, even though the kids left notes or whatever saying, you know, I'm being bullied. I've been bullied to death. I can't stand this anymore. It's unbearable. Nope. He blamed their parents. You didn't teach them not to be all gay and LGBTQQIA plus whatever. You didn't teach them not to do that. If you would have whooped some heterosexual sense into them, your babies might still be alive and maybe bullying some other little gay kid. Yeah. I mean, this guy's a real turd. And so, among other things, it was just a couple of years ago when he said, no, we can't let our adoption agencies here in Tennessee where God loves us and we love God and God don't like no homosexuals. We can't be letting them LGBTQ people. We can't be letting them adopt little children's what needs parents. Because they don't need them kind of parents. And fortunately, there's even audio of what happened today.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move to concur in Senate Joint Resolution 609.
We have some concerns on this SJR, and I make a motion to send it back to naming and designating.
I'd like to know, for the record, the source of the concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It wasn't heard in committee, and I feel like it needs to be.
I'm just a co-sponsor for Senator Ackberry, who introduced this resolution, proud to carry it in the House. The Senate passes 30-0.
A lot of SJRs are not heard in committee, and we vote on them. We voted on a couple of them today, as a matter of fact. The country music artist, T.J. Osborne? We're talking about a country music singer, y'all. Come on.
I-63, 23 nays, 4 present on vote. The motion prevails.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
The resolution was sent to a committee that has already closed for the entire year.
And even the Tennessee Senate, as they pointed out, you know, for God's sakes, not exactly a bastion of wild-eyed critical race theory, espousing wokeness, teaching political correctness, believing wild-eyed AOC liberal Democrat socialist, 30-0.
And we can't have that here in Tennessee. Nope, can't have it.
But the funny thing is that so representing Faison actually has competition. Enter representing Justin Lafferty. He's from Knoxville, because apparently there's somebody, a whole bunch of somebodies in Knoxville that think he's doing just a bang-up job. And here we are talking about history again, damn it. Well, representing Lafferty got up in the Tennessee legislature to explain why it was that the three-fifths compromise was put into the Constitution. It ain't why you think. It weren't that enslaved peoples was just deemed to be three-fifths of a human being. No. According to Representing Lafferty, who done rewrit the entirety of American history, it was so's that they done looked in the crystal balls there in 1787 and said if we go ahead and declare that people what is slaves is three fifths of a human being, somewhere down the road we're probably going to just end slavery. That's what we're going to do. Jesus Christ, where do they come up with this shit? Well, I already know the answer. This sounds like something straight out of who's that fraud merchant that runs wall builder, David Barton, the guy who had his own book turned down by a House of Jesus publishing house because it was so full of falsehoods that even they couldn't publish it in good conscience. It must be downright fun to watch the Tennessee House in well, no, it's not fun. It's infuriating, but at least it's interesting. And they got a lot better audio than we do in West Virginia. Maybe West Virginia ought to talk to Tennessee. Yeah.
The Three-Fifths Compromise was a direct effort to ensure that southern states never got the population necessary to continue the practice of slavery everywhere else in the country.
Holy shit. And nobody jumped up and said, you are crazier in the head and the hog is in the ass. My God, son, if your brains was gas, you wouldn't have enough to, pour, to run a piss-ants motorcycle around a BB. Jesus.
What does that mean? Appropriation based on...
That means you're crazy. That means you're nuts. Or maybe it means you're just a willful liar. Maybe it means you're a historical revisionist. And because this is radio and not video, I will have to tell you that from a visual standpoint, there's something more than a little bit amusing about the fact that representing Lafferty is standing there on camera opining about the purpose of the Three-Fifths Compromise. And instead of a legislator in the seat next to the next to him, no, the seat next to representing Lafferty is occupied by a Chick-fil-A bag. No shit. And while I would not any more go to Chick-fil-A than no. I have in the past, I confess. But I promised myself, no more Chick-fil-A. No more hate filet. No more Jesus chicken. While I'm no fan of Chick-fil-A, and son of a gun, they've moved their product into grocery stores. You can now buy the world-famous Chick-fil-A sauce on your grocer's shelves. This is not an unpaid product placement. It tastes like shit. It's made out of poison chemicals, and you don't want to be anywhere near it. But they're out there hustling their Chick-fil-A sauce and their Polynesian sauce, which has never been has nothing absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with Polynesia. And hell, the original founder of Chick-fil-A despises gay Polynesians too. Never mind. But with all that having been said, the empty chair with the Chick-fil-A bag in it is actually doing a better job as a member of the Tennessee legislature than representing Justin Lafferty. They was trying to keep... how about that? The Three-Fifths Clause is an attempt to keep the good, decent, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, Christian, white, southern slave-owning plantation holders, trying to keep them down, don't you understand?
Three-Fifths Compromise was a direct effort to ensure that southern states never got the population necessary to continue the practice of slavery everywhere else in the country. What does that mean? Appropriation based on population. That's how we pick. Everybody in here knows we've got nine state representatives. By limiting the number of population in the count, they specifically limited the number of representatives that would be available in the slaveholding states, and they did it for the purpose of ending slavery well before Abraham Lincoln. Well before a civil war. Do we talk about that? I don't hear that anywhere.
Well, that's because it didn't happen that way, dumbass. Please. Oh, sweet fake baby Jesus, reach down and straighten... Sometimes it's painful. It is.
In this conversation across the country, I don't know how we've gotten here. I don't know what we do about it. But talking about changing our history, changing's not the right word. Talking about incorporating another view of history while ignoring the very writings that we have access to is no way to go about it.
Representing Lafferty's upset about critical race theory, too. And he don't want no 1619 project being taught to the precious, impressionable minds of the children of the state of Tennessee. Here's the thing. Let's take this little walk back into history for a moment. Northern states, in the course of the debates over the ratification of the Constitution, agreed to the three-fifths compromise because the southern states actually wanted to count every slave as a full human being who would not have the right to vote, of course, and would have no representation whatsoever, but it would increase their numbers in the House of Representatives. So the North said, yeah, all right, three-fifths of a human being, whatever. And that actually allowed in the House of Representatives, that allowed the southern states to have more members of the House than they would otherwise have deserved. And that is how, during the 19th century, the late 18th and early, and up into the, you know, up till 1861, when they started lobbing shells at a federal installation in Charleston Harbor. And I don't mean no conch shells neither. It meant that the South was overrepresented in the House, and they were able thereby to prevent any discussion of slavery from taking place whatsoever, at all. And as I've mentioned before, I saw in my tour of the Capitol once upon a time, the very desk where John Quincy Adams, having been president of the United States, returned to the House of Representatives, the only president ever so to do, and authored a bill to address the issue of slavery, which he found disgusting and repugnant, and was censured, shut down, silenced, forbidden from even breathing the word abolition in the House of Representatives of the Congress of the United States of America. Apparently, no one mentioned that to Representative Lafferty, because nobody taught him that their critical race theory. And you know what? He says we've got the primary source documents. What he's saying is not in the primary source documents. He's oblivious. He's 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound onion bag. And so, that goes hand in hand with what Flavio pointed out earlier today about representing Garofalo down there in Louisiana, said, we got to teach the good parts about slavery. You know, the part where maybe the slaves didn't die after they'd been whipped. They was taken care of. Omar sent somebody down to the quarters, and they put bacon grease on the whipping wounds, and then, you know, he's able to go out in the cane fields and chop cane the very next day. And the best part of all is after Representative Garofalo did that, well, up jumped the Women's Republican Club of New Orleans. Because, of course, the president of the Women's Republican Club of New Orleans immediately defended Representative Garofalo on Sunday. Martha Huckabee. And she's a former delegate for Donald Trump to the Republican National Convention. She got all mad because CNN reported on Representative Garofalo, who said children should be taught about the good of slavery. And Martha Huckabee said slavery goes all the way back to biblical times, and oh my God, there we are again. Making the same argument that the gospel sharps in the pews and the churches were making in 1840. Slavery goes all the way back to biblical times, and if you've read your Bible, you would know that many of the slaves loved their masters, and their masters loved them and took very good care of them and their families. The question he should have pushed back her way was there marriages in slavery? Were families and precious babies born, and I'm talking about life itself, into or out of slavery? Were slave owners ever known to be good to their slaves? Were slave owners ever known to love their masters? Some slaves never wanted to leave their plantation because it had become their home. We need to stop allowing liberals that have been indoctrinated through Marxism to run our House and Senate. These people do not see through clear lenses. Their views are skewed, S-S-C-U-E-D, skew, like Trey Crowder says, skew. Their views are skewed and very one-sided. Slavery's been around since before Jesus Christ came to take away the sins of the world. Today's slavery topic is a leftist trap. It is neither true nor based on real facts. Some days I miss the bottle of cheap rot-gut tequila and the swirly straw. I do, I really, really do. This is why we can't have good things in America. Yes, I agree, Ralphs. Please fake baby Jesus. Slap that representative upside his head. And as to Chick-fil-A, hi, Jeremy. If you look really close, their chicken is a lot like Jesus was. You know, white skin, blue eyes, long, dirty blonde hair, and yep, all never married to a clucking hen. Damn, Jeremy, you're just bringing the A game tonight, aren't you? Chick-fil-A, Lee in New York says, if it's just chemicals, maybe Trump's calling it COVID vaccine. Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A sauce.
Maybe you could inject the Chick-fil-A sauce. I hear it has some Jesus in it.
Back to representing Faison. Steve in New York says, why don't these fuckers grow up here and be honest about their bigotry? You know which word he really wants to say. Oh, yes, we do know which word he really wants to say. And make no mistake, though, Steve, he says the word. He just tries not to say it where anybody can hear it. Because then he'd get canceled. Cancel culture. And there it is. I mentioned it earlier when Darlene sent the story along. Thank you, Flavio. Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, filed the request for a new trial alleging that the former officer's ability to have a fair trial is affected by pretrial publicity. Dateline today, NBC News. NBC's Nelson's filing, Eric Nelson, the pettifogger who represented oh so badly Derek Chauvin, also accuses Minnesota state prosecutors of committing pervasive prejudicial and prosecutorial misconduct, and that kept him from getting a fair trial, too. And they'll probably file an addendum or an amended motion. Well, we done seen a juror what was wearing a Black Lives Matter T-shirt. Oh, God. It's like Tracy said, it just gets so exhausting. But hey, you got $1 million? If you got $1 million or so, you might be able to bid on a bottle of Petrus 2000. That's a wine. Mm-hmm. And how does this happen? How is this kind of commerce allowed into scientific? I don't know, because, see, here's the thing. It's not worth $1 million. Under any set of circumstances? I mean, maybe if it was a fifth of Pappy Van Winkle, 30-year-old, what the fuck, it'd be a different story. But this is just a bottle of vino, red wine. And Christie's, the auction house, is going to put it on the block in a private sale. And it's one of 12 such bottles. A European startup called Space Cargo Unlimited sent 12 bottles of Petrus 2000 into orbit with the International Space Station as part of research into how food and drink, particularly wine, matures in space. You know, you're a wine snob. You buy the wine, you take it down to the cellar, you lay it down, and I remember, I think it was 2017 when Agnes and I were touring the Antoine's of New Orleans. and they told us what about what happened when Katrina came along. Antoine's was famous for its wine cellar, and it was all lost. There was seriously old, expensive wine. It was lost. Must have been a hell of an insurance claim. We don't pay. Act of God. Hurricanes are definitely act of God. We don't pay. But anyway, Space Cargo Unlimited sent 12 bottles of this wine into space, and it spent 440 days up there, over a year. And in a press release, Space Cargo Unlimited's Nicolas Gomme said that the wine went up to the International Space Station on November the 2nd, 2019, in a Cygnus capsule. It came back on January the 14th, 2021, aboard one of Elon Musk's SpaceX Dragon capsules. Somewhere along the way, I'm sure Elon made a buck or two. And a wine science institute in Bordeaux, La Belle France, said, "The bottles positively endured all the constraints of preparation, travel, and storage on the ESS." That, according to Christie's. And to make it more saleable, there was a blind tasting, and the expert wine tasters, the ones who spit the wine in the bucket and they never swallow, and don't swallow. We note a remarkable difference in the color, aroma, and taste components in the space wine as compared to wine that has remained here upon the planet Earth. I told them we already got one. The wines sampled were commended for their complexity and considered to be great wines. Heretofore, the most ever paid at auction for a bottle of vino was $558,000 in 2018 for a bottle of 1945 Romane Conti Burgundy. And Sotheby's got some sap to drop almost a half a million, but they're saying that no, they expect to get $1 million a bottle for this stuff. Oh, wait, okay, so there's kind of a benefit aspect to it. Proceeds will go towards funding future space missions focused on agricultural research. And Petru, I think it's not Petrus, that's how we'd say it here in West Virginia, Petrus. I think it's Petru from Pomerol near Bordeaux. Supposedly that's one of the best wines in the whole wide world, right up there with your Mad Dog 2020 and your Annie Green Springs. No, I added that part. If you want to sit down and stick a straw in a bottle of your Petru, and you're, say, at a fine dining location in Europe, and because, you know, maybe you want to have a little COVID with your wine, it'll set you back $5,400 for a bottle of wine. And I understand market dynamics, but can somebody please explain to me how it's kind of a parallel to what Matt in San Francisco wrote last night when he was talking about the divorce between Bill and Melinda Gates and said, "You got all that money, and yet one of you looks at the other and says, I don't care how rich we are, there is not enough money to make me spend one second more with you." Also corollary to the thing that bartenders say at the end of the night and last call, "You ain't got to go home, just got to go somewhere else." Well, this is kind of that. How rich do you have to be? How utterly devoid of any concern whatsoever for anything else going on the planet except your desire for a glass of wine? How divorced from your common humanity do you have to be to drop $5,400 on a bottle of wine? Jesus, Anthony Bourdain, why did you have to off yourself? That just begs for his input. By the way, I guess the final Bourdain book is out. It's kind of a rehash of previous conversations. And I haven't gotten it yet, but I think I probably will. But I've known wine snobs, and what they will tell me, or what they've told me in the past, is, you know, don't get worked up about the label. If it tastes good, it's good wine. On the other hand, if it's got the label you do want to worry about is the Trump label, and if it comes from Trump vineyards, don't open it. You would probably get cited by the EPA for chemical dumping if you poured it on the ground. But, and I don't know, maybe Chateau Pretru, maybe those crazy ass prices keep them in business. Who knows? Well, I don't know, Ralphs. They set up, Ralphs says, so they sent up a whole case of wine. They sent up 12 bottles. And we know that they opened at least one of them. Leah, New York, points out my lack of taste. I have a friend who likes good wines. I told him he'll buy a bottle of wine; it'll be ready in 10 years. I drink soda. I can buy a bottle and drink from it in the same day. You Philistine, you! Oh, sorry. Well, we all know that I get all, and you know, I got to go south to get it. We all know that I get all worked up about Diet Grapeco. But of course, because you know I'm just a little plebeian chick. I am curious. I'd love to know what it is about a $5,400 slug of wine that makes it better than a $12 bottle from Kroger. Ah, well, you see, you barbarian, you. This a $5,400 bottle has overtones of old baseball gloves, and hints of stone fruit, and sometimes a little bit of horsehair. And le terroir. Jesus. I did go through a beer snob phase, I admit. And I really can tell the difference. Could. But that's more a difference in styles. You know, Rauschbier versus a Belgian triple, or, you know, a Bock, or a stout. No. But, Jesus. Maybe that's it. Wait a minute. I think I just found... I found out why the Gateses are divorcing. Bill bid on all 11 bottles. And he told Melinda that she couldn't have any. Is that it? Could that possibly be it? Space-aged wines, wine from space. Lee says, how high do the purchasers expect to get? Jeremy, oh, God, no, Trump wine has no grapes. It's just aged, bottled, bitter Ivanka piss. The older, the bitchier. Help me out here, Stephen, New York says. When I was a kid in high school, not once, never, not yet, nine, now, no, did anyone, ever lament the fact that we didn't learn the positive aspects of slavery? Well, that was then, and this is now, Steve. They're probably lamenting that all over Southern Ohio. Because Southern Ohio was practically Kentucky. Still is. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just had to... I love those little stories of the rich behaving richly. get the tumbrel. And that's true, Steve in New York pointing out, sommelier are bullshit artists. Without getting into the details, I had a conversation with David Remnick on the subway once. He's the editor of the New Yorker. He referenced this article to me, The Red and the White from the New Yorker magazine. The rub, sommeliers can't tell the difference between white and red. Really? Wow. Yeah. I can't wait to read that article. Okay, let's run over to the stress line, see who we got. Hey, welcome to the program. Did you quit on me? No, you're still there.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hey, Bob. I'm Lee Robin. How you doing? It's me, Reggie from Decatur, Georgia.
Hey, Reggie. How are you, buddy? How are you?
Just fine, Robin. Just fine. Sorry it took me so long to get back to my cell phone, but I had to help my mother out.
Well, you're a good son. You know,
I had to give her a credit card case, you know.
Sure.
But anyway, 2 days ago, I just happened to be up at around 11:15, and I had to use the bathroom. And I got caught up watching This Week with George Snuffleupagus. Of course, he wasn't there. His girlfriend.
Oh, you poor, you poor man.
Yeah. I only watched it for those two women that were on there, Rachel Scott and somebody else. It was a black woman and another colored woman. So I think it's black. I could be wrong. I was just looking at them. You know, I'm a guy. Men are visual. We're visual creatures as men. If she's beautiful, fine. If she's not, forget it. You know what I'm saying, Robin?
I'm going to let that one fly by, and we'll just keep moving.
Right. But anyway, I was watching it. They were talking about Joe Biden's first 100 days in office, and you had Fatso, Chris Christie, and Ron Emanuel there. They were polar opposites. Ron Emanuel said he's doing excellent, and Chris Christie, not so much. So I got cut up from
How did dude get that? Wingnut welfare drives me crazy, Reggie. I don't know about you, but it drives me crazy. All you got to do is be some shit-eating Republican, and there is a multi-million dollar a year job waiting for you in the for-profit media.
You mean like Chris Christie and, I don't know if Martha Raddatz is a Republican, but don't forget, he subs in for George Snuffleupagus. And what about those women? What about those
Rick Brofro Mick Santorum. Dude is a stone cold racist, and there is nothing he can say that will not make CNN fire him when CNN gladly and happily fires people of color for just thinking something critical of white folks.
Right. Why would they do that? I thought they were supposed to be diverse, or should I say progressive.
Because the suits are sensitive to the delicate feelings of white fragility in people like Rick Santorum.
Right.
I remain convinced to this day, Reggie, that Rick Santorum could show up on the set at CNN wearing his white robe with his little Kliegel symbol on it and his pointy white hat, and no one, and they wouldn't fire him.
Well, he has a right to his opinion. We need his opinion.
What if he had a torch in his hand? Don't forget what they used to do with those torches, right?
Sure. But you get my point.
Yeah. Like you said, he come in his Klan uniform, lit torch and all, and they say, well, he's just exercising his skill with constitutional and human rights. What?
I know.
And they wouldn't fire him? I think CNN itself needs to be fired, and by that I mean the seat that running. But when it was ran by Ted Turner, it was a whole different scene, right, Robin? It was a whole different scene. He created it.
Sure.
He ran it. It was a whole different scene. He didn't tolerate any crap, any bullshit, even from anybody. Now it's being run by these suits. you know, who will tolerate anything and everything. And even if, you know, do you think that Brian Stelter would say anything, and they would try to fight him for speaking the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, to help him guide Jesus in heaven?
Oh, no, I don't care what network it is. If you comment from the left, or from seriously the left, you walk on eggshells. But if you're a racist wingnut, you can say anything in the world because it's great. Oh, Reggie, it's great for clicks.
Yeah, but what if those clicks get somebody killed? Like,
well, it doesn't matter. It frankly doesn't matter. Because the money matters more, and so there's no way they can't be legally reached, Reggie, and so no liability attaches.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I'm trying to think. Reza Aslan was dumped from CNN for something he didn't even say on air.
Right. Anybody else, Robin?
Yeah, there are. Wajahat Ali, I think.
Yeah, right.
Dumped.
Man. Jesus.
It's actually a fairly long list of people that CNN has dumped. For shit that shouldn't even have gotten him in trouble.
Right, and I'm sure there's plenty of women on that list, right, Robin? Or am I wrong on that?
No, I think you're right. But
never said it.
Yeah. And you know how bad Rick Santorum is, Reggie. You're bad when Meghan McCain tweets Rick Santorum has always been an absolute asshole.
Yeah. Ooh. And she's on The View.
And but she's, you know, she's the princess of privilege.
Yeah, white privilege. And they're afraid to fire her because
white girl McCain privilege.
Yeah. You know, they're afraid to fire her, but you know, some have stood up against her, like Joy and Whoopi. Now I know she ain't gonna fuck with Whoopi. You know.
No, but the larger point is when Meghan McCain says you're an asshole.
Yeah,
you're an asshole.
Right. I'm surprised she finally took this long to say that about him, and Trump for that matter. I'm surprised it took this long. And you know, and of course, Martha Raddatz went soft on Chris Christie. You know, I think he went soft on, well, I don't know about Ronnie Manning, but I know she spoke, shall we say, she was cautious eggshells to Chris Christie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fat boy. What about Joe Biden? And of course, Ronnie Manning had to oppose him with facts. You know, why don't they ask isn't she supposed to be a journalist or a commentator, Martha Raddatz, you know, Georgie's girlfriend. You know.
Yeah, so Reza Aslan, this is just CNN, mm-hmm. Reza Aslan, Wajahat Ali, Octavia Nasser, Mark Lamont Hill, and they're all kind of the same kind of hue or shade or tone of skin.
We're one black and the rest are Muslim. Right?
And they kept maggot Jeffrey Lord on CNN so long that, they did eventually can him, but only after he gave the Heil Hitler salute on air.
Damn. It took that to get rid of him?
So maybe the Klan robe would get rid of Rick Santorum, but now that, but with Jeffrey Lord's example before him, he's not going to show up with his Klan robe.
Right. I wonder has MSNBC fired everybody. You know. you know, the one with your morning, your filthy, guilty morning habits. I wouldn't have they gotten rid of anyone for just being themselves, like, you know.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. Yeah.
Over at the Daily Beast, Wajahat Ali said, "The lesson from all these examples is crystal clear for most commentators of color. You can be a nativist, a bigot, an Islamophobe, a homophobe, a creep, and a liar, but as long as you're good for the bottom line and you don't piss off the right-wing outrage mob, you're good for cable news. If you happen to be a white conservative like Rick Santorum, you will always have a blank slate to birth new controversies."
Right.
Ta-da!
But if you're not, then you're gone.
Yeah. See ya. Wouldn't want to be ya.
Yeah, if you're not, then you're gone. I mean, how do they stay in business? And this is the exact same network that's supposed to be diverse and progressive, correct? Supposed to be liberal. And left.
Oh, sure, yeah. CNN, goddamn liberals. Right.
Wasn't it the Clinton News Network at one point in time not too long ago, Robin?
Oh, yeah. My friend's the Clinton News Network, but the guy who used to say that's all busy being dead.
Rush Limbaugh, right.
Yeah, Reggie, he's still dead. People worry about that, but yes, he is.
Yes, but what about the Fox News box? You know, like you said, the Fox News TV radio will wonder. They'll hire anybody who was told about a lie or bend over and kiss their ass, if you will, you know? Like the Fox News box. You know who I'm talking about, right?
And here's the thing we need to bear in mind. I mean, this is just media stuff.
Yeah,
but there's good money. There's good money to be had by liberals at Fox. Fox pays well. Make no mistake.
Very well.
But here's the rub, Reggie. If you decide to take Mr. Murdoch's money and cash Mr. Murdoch's checks, you do Mr. Murdoch's bidding, which means that if you sign on to be a token liberal at Fox, they'll let you say just about anything you want. But the rule is the right winger always gets the last word and gets to tap dance on your noggin. Because they understand message discipline, and they understand the psychology of messaging over at Fox. And the last thing that Emery and Marvelline here, sitting in their matching Barkle loungers in the trailer down at the Ballerina Swan Lake trailer court and country club, is that whatever Emery and Marvelline here last is what's going to stay with them. And so you take the check, you say liberal stuff, you say, yeah, but people need to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. And then the host says, well, yeah, but that's because you're a communist and you don't love America. And they hand you the check, and you go cash the check, and, well, you don't have any dignity left, but you got a lot of money.
Right. Right. That's true. And there is one token. There's one radio talk show host who's also a liberal Democratic commentator and contributor, and that's Leslie Marshall. I think I told you about her, haven't I, Robin?
Yeah.
Well, she works for, you know, but she works for them. But she's a Democratic liberal, you know, commentator and contributor. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But she's an excellent person. She's excellent. Well, she has mouths to feed. I guess that's why she does it. She has kids, you know?
Yeah, well,
she has mouths to feed.
And you know, maybe it's go just ahead. Maybe it's all maybe it's all there are some people for whom this is all just a big game, Reggie. It's just a big game. I've heard stories about how Sean Hannity would say, "Listen, this is all just bullshit. I just do this because the money's good. I don't believe any of this crap."
Right. Right.
Now, I don't know if that statement is true or not, but it certainly is believable because there's no, it's just about manipulating the rubes. This is all just P.T. Barnum stuff. Everything Rupert Murdoch has ever done in his career has been based on the P.T. Barnum model.
Right. Right, that's true.
You're just getting the rubes all worked up, and when the rubes get worked up, the rubes you can separate the rubes from their money.
Right. I wonder if the same is true with Greg Gutfeld and Brian Kilmeade and Jeanine Pirro. You know, do they do it there for the money?
Oh, well, I think.
You know, I wonder if...
I don't know. You reckon Jeanine's made enough money yet that she can bid on one of those bottles of wine? Or will she not drink it because it doesn't come in a box?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's both. Oh, I forgot to add Laura Ingraham to that list. I wonder if she herself does do it for the money. You know?
I know.
But I wonder if she herself do it for the money. Yeah, I guess it's just for their bullshitters, right, Robin? They sit up there and read teleprompters, you know, like actors do.
Well, I'm not going to criticize anybody. Right? I'm not going to criticize anybody for reading a teleprompter because that's just how that gig works.
Right, but they're bullshitters nonetheless, right, Robin? They sit up there and bullshit people. I mean, the gullible ones, that is, the gullible lemmings, right? Robin.
Sure. Well,
not those who don't watch it.
Gullibility is everything. Gullibility is everything with right-wing broadcasting.
Yeah, radio, television, hell, the internet, right?
Sure.
I wonder how well CNN pays their employees. Well, them or
I don't know. Reggie, when I was there, it was not a union shop, and every now and then somebody would try to organize us. And they'd give us a dollar an hour raise or something.
But they didn't pay too well, did they?
It wasn't terrible.
Yeah. What?
I mean, I know a guy who was building pool tables in Atlanta at the same time that I was reading the news. Arguably, he worked a lot harder, and he got paid about $7,000 or $8,000 more a year than I did as a editor and newscaster.
Oh man. Oh, that's not right. Y'all should have gotten paid for what y'all was worth. Full days pay for a full day's work, right? Or full days pay for a full day's honest work, right, Robin?
Mm-hmm.
Y'all should have gotten exactly what y'all deserve. You know, you put in your time over there, and what do you get? Nothing or next to nothing. Or chump change, you know, peanuts, right?
Sure.
And meanwhile, Fox is over there living it up, right? Living high off the hog, if you will. I don't know about the rest of them. But that ain't right. How come the right gets a whole lot more money than the left does?
Well, because that's the way that particular market is structured, and that's also the right wing will pay anybody who will get out there and say batshit crazy right wing stuff, Reggie. And they don't care that they're never going to see the money again. They don't care that there's not going to be a profit made. It does not goddamn matter. They just want the message out there. Our side, not so much. Our side, not so much. There are organizations out there, and friends of mine can tell you about it far more than I because they've got experience with it, who will spend $1,000 on donuts for a meeting.
Right.
And $5,000 on paper fans and pens and pencils and little pads of notepaper.
But will not
pay somebody who is day in and day out doing the hard work of carrying the message. And it's because they're lost in a different time, Reggie. That's why they are so star spangled awful.
Oh, they are. Like you said, they're lost in a different time era, or time warp, or time setting there. That's where they're lost, you know? Like you said, that's where they're lost, because they're in a different time set, a mental time set, right, Robin?
Sure.
You know, they need to evolve. Is that what you're saying, Robin? They need to evolve.
I'll let you say that, Reggie.
What?
I don't know.
Well, you know, like I said, go ahead, Robin.
No, it's just...
Go ahead, Rob.
No, it's fine. It's just that,
yeah.
You know, evolve, right-wingers, evolve, or the dinosaurs on our side just quietly, you know, go away.
Well, we gotta push them out somehow. They have to pass the torch, or should I say the mic in this instance, down to the new generation.
Hold on there. I'm one of those old farts, Reggie. I'm not ready to pass the mic to nobody just yet.
Well, but you evolved, Robin. You evolved.
I guess you could say I'm doing some evolving.
Yeah, you're not corporatized like the rest of them. Are you, Robin? No, you're not.
No. You can say a lot about me, but that's not one of the things you can say.
You're not corporatized. So if you were, you wouldn't be able to get away with saying most of the stuff you're saying to me, you're telling me about right now, right? You'd be like going to the principal's office in high school. You'd be sitting in your boss's office after the show. He'll grill you over things that you said over the airwaves.
Right. Yeah. No. I like the principal's office analogy better because you know then you walk out of there with the much cherished 3-day vacation. I got a few of those in my day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but you know they'll lecture and grill you about what you said. You know, something that you shouldn't have said and you didn't apologize for. But why would you apologize for speaking the truth? Why should you, right, Robin?
Right, sure. Hey, Reggie, I got to wrap stuff up because it's about the end of showtime, but it's awful good talking to you, my friend. Hope things are going well for you down there. Have you got your shot yet, Reggie?
Yes, I have. I'm done. I got two of them. I'm done. What about you, Robin?
What did you get, Moderna or Pfizer?
I got two of mine. I don't know, but I just got a vaccination shot.
Good. I'm proud of you. I'm happy for you. And your mama?
What about you?
Her
too, and my sister too.
Excellent. That's just wonderful news to hear. I'm fully vaccinated, and my immunity is fully developed. So, I'm looking forward to a wonderful summer.
Well, what about you and your family and friends? Have they been fully vaccinated?
I'm fully vaccinated, and so is Agnes.
Oh, good. Well, what about the rest of them?
Let's see. Three out of four are.
You know,
one still isn't vaccinated.
Oh. Well, I hope you get him or her vaccinated, Robin. Are you trying to convince them to do it?
For all I'm worth, Reggie. For all I'm worth.
What? You're trying to convince them, and they stubbornly refuse to do it. Oh, what is that? Oh, don't tell me that Fox News has crept inside their head.
No. This is just plain old cussed hillbilly cantankerousness.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Don't they know that they're going to die if they don't get vaccinated? You know?
Reggie, it is a complicated discussion, my friend. But I do, I gotta roll on, and you know, you take care and you stay safe. And now that you and the family are vaccinated, I hope you all have a wonderful, wonderful summer, but you got to stay safe.
Yeah, I hope so too, Robin. It rained over here today and yesterday. What about your weather?
Oh, it's just poured. We're trying to do a lot of work on the house, and you know, it's hard to do in the pouring rain.
Yeah, that's true. It's like working on the yard in the pouring rain.
Yeah, by the time it dries out, the grass will be up to my freaking knees.
Right. Then you got to cut it down again.
Well, all summer long, but I enjoy it, and it's good for me. I need the exercise, and it's good to work up a good sweat and get a little sun.
Right. Yeah, I hear you on that. Right?
Now I got a big floppy hat to protect me from the sun because, you know, I burn under the refrigerator bulb. Reggie, you take care of yourself, my friend. Right. You have a good evening, all right? We'll talk soon.
You do, too.
All right.
Okay, Robin.
Later. Bye now. Right. Our buddy Reggie calling from Decatur, Georgia. Note from Shorty in L.A. we might have stopped this guy. It's been some years. Now this fucker Dave has no schedule on his calendar. Preview, of course, at Grossman Academy. This place teaches and trains U.S. police officers. Wait for it. Killology. And the guy running the killology the police training course, recently we found out, and I guess this is cancel culture too, he had been heard to say that the greatest sex in the world was after, as a cop, the greatest sex in the world was after you kill somebody. He said, it's a perk of the job. A retired Army Lieutenant Colonel with a master's in education and counseling psychology, Dave Grossman is one of America's best-known independent police trainers and one of the foremost exponents of the warrior cop mindset. Under the aegis of his killology research group, he defines killology as the scholarly study of the destructive act, just as sexology is the scholarly study of the procreative act. Grossman travels the country offering continuing education seminars to cops and cop adjacents. He musters scientific research, anecdotal evidence, and a boatload of presuppositions in order to prepare his students for the realities of combat while valorizing the notion that the thin blue line is humanity's last bulwark against total societal collapse. Yeah, dude reminds me of the same... It's the same thing on different sides of the... It's a coin with the same thing on both sides, is what I'm trying to say. I've read stories of sociopaths and serial killers who will actually orgasm when they kill. And here's a cop or a cop trainer who says that the best sex you'll ever have is after you kill someone. I know people like that. Not cops, but I know people who love to kill things. And that's when they're having their most fun, is when they're watching the life drain out of another living thing. I don't understand it. I was working on the barbecue over the weekend, and I saw some little creature crawling along, and just without thinking, I went squish. And I gave myself shit for it. I said, well, that was a senseless waste of life. The thing wasn't doing anything to you. Mindfulness. Well, we never quite got to matching Joey and Giraffe's challenge. But thanks, Jeremy, for trying. I guess tomorrow we'll be at $600. But thank you just the same, Jeremy. And thanks, Joey and Giraffe, for making the opportunity and the offer. And thanks to all of you, our subscribers, Patreon and PayPal, and our a la carte contributors. You're why this program does exist. Thank you so much. Thanks to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program, howsoever you may choose to so do. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks most kindly to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Remember, brand new Fresh Malloy on the way, 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. The best place to listen to the first run of Malloy is, of course, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20+ years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. This would be a great time for you to reach out and call your member of the House and ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AIC Act. It means the world to Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Please stay safe. Get your vaccine whenever you possibly can. If you have already gotten your vaccine, continue to be safe. If you are in big groups that you don't know who's vaccinated and who's not, wear your mask. Continue to wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Carry your hand sanitizer. Make use of it. We're not back to normal. Everything's not okay yet. Maintain your social distance. And, you know, if somebody comes towards you saying, the Three-Fifths Compromise was a way to end slavery, avoid that person like the plague. Because he is. Later, y'all.